You're listening to a Stranger podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Dear listener, again, thank you for downloading yet another Dear Science podcast. I'm Jonathan Golub, the science writer here at The Stranger, and with me today is Charles Mudede, expert on zoophilia in the state of Washington, and filmmaker, author of the Police Beat column and movie of the same name. Charles, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad you introduced me that way.
We're here to talk about the recent HIV vaccine failure, and I'm going to really quickly go through what happened here. This was probably the most promising anti-HIV vaccine to come out in a decade, and it had a really nifty idea behind it, which was to put some of the interior proteins of HIV in a cold virus. The immune system hates cold virus, immediately puts up the dukes to fight it off, and so the idea was if you put HIV proteins in a cold virus, the immune system say, okay, everyone's bad, sort of guilt by association, and make a really strong immune response when it gets exposed later on to HIV. That was the idea, and it sounds great, and it worked great in monkeys, it worked great in all these preliminary experiments. So they recruited 3,000 people worldwide, mostly gay men or female sex workers, on a bunch of sites in the United States, but in Seattle was one of them. There are 119 gay men who were recruited for this study here in Seattle. So one of the concerns when they were planning the study was that if you had already had this cold virus before, that the vaccine wouldn't work. And it's sort of, it's something that's pithily known as original antigenic sin. This happens with flu vaccines and a couple other vaccines. And the idea is, it's kind of, again, the idea, you meet someone next to the guy who mugged you last week, and you may not pay too much attention to the other guy. You kind of focus your attention on the mugger and when you get ready to run off. And so the idea was, even if you see the vaccine, your immune system, if you'd seen that cold virus before, your immune system would react to the cold virus and ignore the HIV proteins. That was a concern, but so initially, people who had seen this cold virus were not allowed to join the study, but then they added them in later on, and it was this group of people that had had the cold virus before and then got the vaccine that it didn't just not work for them, it actually looks like it put this group of people at higher risk for HIV infection in the future. So this is somewhat of a disaster. This is probably the worst end result of any HIV vaccine trial. And they're just now starting to unravel it and start telling people who are in the trial which group they were in, if they're at heightened risk, and so on and so forth. So Charles, one of the things I was going to ask you about, because it brings up an interesting ethical question. I mean, everything after the fact makes a lot of sense, but every step along the way, what do you think about people volunteering to join in one of these trials?
You know, I have to be honest. It's very funny. The first thing that I always say, well, what came to my mind, oddly enough, was the plastinated bodies that donated them. You know, they said that when I die, you can plastinate me and turn me into a sculpture. If someone is adequately warned about what the risks are, and I think the issue was, do they know? And you know that this is, after all, science, right? I mean, it's bound. I mean, it gets things correct a lot of times, but also gets things wrong. And I don't think there is, without doing it, there's no way we could have known if it would work or not. So I'm on the end to say that if you feel that this is a part of the political cause or the political issue to reach a solution to a disease that's devastated lots of lives, and you think you're participating in that, and you're willing to take the risk, and there's an understanding. I really can't. It's hard for me to find. I mean, it's terrible that it went wrong, but the science is never perfect. So you could say that they made mistakes, but my God, look how much we've learned. Just even describing the mistakes that they made in this issue, and it opens a lot of people to thinking about other approaches. Like, oh, you can't do that; that won't work, or this has to be considered. So to me, if I'm correct about science, is that a failure can also be rewarding.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's a well-designed study. Is a study where at least a part of it doesn't care what the result is. You can get into trouble in science when you're trying to accomplish a certain goal, and certainly a vaccine, you're trying to accomplish a goal. But the purest science is sort of an experiment where no matter which way it turns out, it's informative and you learn something. And it's sort of true. I mean, the blood samples collected along the way are going to be definitely tell this hypothesis I've laid out why the vaccine failed is true. And so this is maybe one of the grinding, because I wrote a news article on this, and I talked with both the people who ran the trial. So the trial was based out of the Hutch here in Seattle. The Hutch in Seattle has the HIV, is the center for the HIV vaccine trials unit, which is one of the largest groups in the world that test HIV vaccines. They've tested many, many, many of them. All of the blood samples end up coming to Seattle. And this is one of the things, Seattle is becoming one of the few world centers for vaccine research. So the human papillomavirus vaccine, which has just been approved and has been very, very successful, was studied here, tested here. The herpes simplex virus vaccine, which is trial, I think, is ending in 2008, and the preliminary data still looks good. That also is being tested here in Seattle, and it's another one that at least in part is based out of here. So Seattle has gotten very good at running these sorts of trials. And so this is one of the really prominent failures that's kind of come out of this group.
What do you think about it? I mean, do you think they should not have done it?
I can't fault any of the decisions along the way. It was a little aggressive to add in the people who had clearly already been exposed to the cold virus. There's a good reason why they were initially excluded. They got a tiny bit of preliminary data and they added them in. And I can understand the logic behind that. While in the United States, people maybe aren't, there's a lower exposure rate to this cold virus, but in where AIDS is very serious, so in particularly sub-Saharan Africa, there's much more of exposure to this cold virus. So any vaccine that was going to be really relevant to combat global HIV had to be a vaccine that would work in people who had already had this exact cold virus before. Mm-hmm. And they have other ones coming down the pike, so give it names. This is adenovirus 5, which is a very common cold virus. Get it. Really makes you miserable for a couple days, but most people just get over it. But it's fairly common worldwide. And so there are other vaccines that are very similar to this based off AD36. So it's another in the family, much rarer. And this is getting maybe a little bit too much in the muck. I think I can't fault them. Like, I don't think this is, for example, the equivalency of the Tuskegee experiment to some of the really unquestionably inappropriate, wrong.
That's right.
Experiments in human trials. But this is the stickiness, and I think this is one of the funny ideas. People get an idea that an experimental treatment is synonymous with good or better, and really, as I think you very eloquently put it, there's no way to know if this is going to work until you run through a trial like this. So no, I can't really fault them. The only thing maybe I think that that the people who ran the trial got a little plotting. They've been very strong and aggressive in promoting this idea that it was a good trial, it was a well-done trial. And from a scientific point of view, I think that's true. But it's a little bit of a tough message to push out on the community of volunteers that now has to deal with the possibility of being at a heightened risk of HIV.
Wow.
And so, oh, sorry.
Please. No. But does this, I mean, what are the pathways? What are the other? I mean, this is one way to deal with AIDS. I mean, what do you know exactly? What are the other?
Yeah, I mean, and so actually, this year overall for HIV has been an interesting one. You have two entirely new drug classes that have become available. You have the integrase inhibitors, and then another type of inhibitor that goes with the triple drugs that have been used and very successfully. So we're at the 10-year anniversary of triple drug therapy. The New England Journal of Medicine paper came out in 1997, mm-hmm. which was earth-shattering. I mean, I'm old enough to remember it. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, and you can read that paper. That's a beautiful paper. If no other reason, that the scientists who wrote the paper were very cautious when they realized they were astonished. You know, the blood levels of HIV went down to undetectable levels, which never happened before. And they said this might be a temporary reprieve, and we still need to do public health measures. And that actually for the 10 years, it's held forth. That was another interesting thing to talk with volunteers in these programs, or just people who are in communities where they're exposed to AIDS. There's almost a totally different way of thinking about the disease. People who were young enough now that all they've known in their mature lives is triple drug therapy being effective against AIDS, and people who remember when regularly someone you know would die from it. And so two new drugs have become available. They're horrifically expensive because they're brand new and they're the first kind of drug in that entire class. But they work. And it's sort of been like another reprieve as HIV and the community started to become resistant to the first line of drugs. New ones are coming out. But this is the other interesting thing in this vaccine. This vaccine, when they tested it in monkeys, did not prevent infection. infection with HIV. In other words, the monkeys still got HIV, and that was not one of the ideas. This vaccine was designed not to prevent you from getting HIV, but to stop you from progressing to getting AIDS, to hold the stalemate back at an earlier point. And so you get into another interesting question. If you are a gay man in Seattle, it's a real actual interesting question. If this vaccine had worked, would you really have had a benefit? And I think there's a case argument, yes. You know, the drugs have a lot of side effects, that they're expensive. Mm-hmm. You have to take them every day for the rest of your life. It's very difficult to skip them because of resistance. And so a vaccine that stops progression to full-blown AIDS, would still be useful. But I think, actually, it would be the most useful in a country where just out of poverty enough that you could distribute a vaccine like this to the whole population. Just to make the difference, HIV is a very serious illness in the United States, but it's a very relatively small portion of the population. If you think about where there's a high HIV load, you're talking about a third of the adult population in the country, a third of the general population being HIV positive. And if you think about that situation, trying to get drugs, the drugs work, but trying to get drugs to a third of the population, even a country like the United States, would be a pretty Herculean task, where there are drugstores in every corner, and there's a reliable cold chain, and distribution networks, and all of the infrastructure that goes with distributing drugs. But I think of like a country, like the classic example would be like Botswana, that's done a very fine job as of late of really combating HIV infection, and it's just kind of coming out of poverty. But to distribute drugs to a third of the population, even a country that's relatively organized and together, is amazing. Whereas a vaccine, you give 3 injections and then the person for the rest of their life never progresses to AIDS and never has to take drugs and has a slightly lower risk of a somewhat lower risk of transmitting the disease to someone else. That was the idea behind this. And so you get this difference in who would benefit from a vaccine like this. I think it would be it makes the act of volunteers in Seattle seem a little bit more altruistic because the relative benefit, I think, is greater for people, other people in the world in different circumstances.
Now, that makes sense. There's I must admit, I used to pay close attention, and I'm one of those persons who thought, well, of all the paths that are probably in front of us for dealing with AIDS in the future, the one that I thought most likely will be one where you suit your life to probably a regimen of drugs and live with it. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect any kind of cure. I thought we'd get probably better and better at developing drugs that lowered what do you call it? I mean,
the viral titer, the viral load.
Yeah, that's right. And that was sort of the thinking. But there was another issue it's so hard in Africa, and of course the rates there are off the register and so on. Zimbabwe is ravaged. Everybody knew it was going to happen. My mother was working in public health at the time as a psychologist, and even in 87 she knew that a storm was heading the way. And she had this sort of sense where she was looking at something that's going to wipe out people. I mean, there's a sense when it's hard to tell people like Noah that, the flood is coming, right? And you just know it and there's nothing you can do. There's this, the clouds are gathering and everybody's is walking in the sun, has no clue. And yet the data is increasing, the University of Zimbabwe, the government is not paying attention. It's worrying about votes and also keeping its promises to the revolution, and that's not working out. And the last thing it wants to hear is there's going to be a public health disaster in a matter of 3 years. And sure enough, it happened. And but then the big question was, the thinking for a lot of people was, why is it hitting us so hard? Why does it hit us as harder than, say, Europeans and Americans? And that was a big question. Some people thought that would, of course, go to sort of the fantastic, that this was designed by Europeans to get us and so on, which is what people need to do or have to do when the world doesn't make any sense. And it seems there's a certain amount of inequality, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of the damage that's done. And my guess, and I'm not sure if this, I'm going to ask you this, my guess was nutrition. My guess was that, and I'm not sure if this is, this could be completely wild, but my thinking was that there probably, that exposure does not always mean contamination. And my thinking was that if you had a healthy body, you probably could fight off an initial infection much, if you looked at the balance, that if you were with a poor diet and a poor immune defense system to begin with, any exposure was probably lethal. That was my thinking. So that was me trying to squeeze a Marxist perspective to the disaster. But I was like, well, I'm not a scientist, but that's what I suspect is that it's diet, nutrition, and so on and so on.
I'm not sure if that'll do it. HIV is it's a little tricky, and it's tricky for an interesting reason. If we're going to pull this back, it's a disaster. But there's one beautiful thing about HIV is that HIV is very closely related to SIV, the monkey virus.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
In fact, HIV-1 is more closely related to the chimpanzee SIV than it is to HIV-2. HIV-2 is much closer to the macaque SIV than it is. So in other words, the two human HIV viruses that are in the wild, in the world population, are much closer to their chimpanzee equivalents. And in the monkeys, it's completely and totally commensal, which means that the monkeys don't get sick. You get the virus and you just sort of have it, and then you just go on your life. And so the virus and the monkey have both sort of made a detente not to fight one another, because the immune system tried to fight off the SIV infection and would cause way more damage than the SIV causes. And it's just the fact that it's got into a human host where the balance is awful, but the virus is a little bit too strong for the human immune system. But the human immune system still, again, this is getting into more and more speculation, still hears all of these let's just both take it easy signals. And so that's why cold viruses we fight off. It's just sort of a death match, head-to-head battle, and then we fight it off. And this is, the theoretical basis for this type of vaccine, is to get the immune system actually fired up to fight this off as something serious. And this comes up.
Oh.
And so one of the reasons why, so you're kind of on, I think, I wouldn't say nutrition, but public health in general is a huge factor in if you're going to get HIV or not. So if you have another STD, if you have syphilis or Haemophilus Ducreyi or chlamydia or gonorrhea, it tremendously increases your chances of getting HIV infection. And so in that sense, your general health has a lot to do with your susceptibility to HIV, and then your sexual practices and everything else. So I would actually say, again, I don't know if it's a Marxist idea, but education and being serious about people's health overall, which nutrition is a component, but even more so, it's just STDs in general.
This is fantastic. I mean, I'm sort of fascinated by this. Then it is an issue of finding a way to live with the virus, right? Then the issue is, first of all, we take a sort of this combat position with the disease that we're going to figure out how to fight it. But now you've just told me something I've never thought about, which is that you could actually, that monkeys live with it. That there's so why is it that they can't, the same cannot be, can be duplicated with humans?
Well, that was the hope with this vaccine, and I think it happens with humans with other viruses. So that's the other interesting thing about HIV is when you get into full-blown AIDS, what the illnesses you actually, it's very rare that someone dies actually from the HIV virus. What you die from are these other illnesses, other pathogens that have come into us that kind of hit the same sort of detente. So like the spots, the Kaposi sarcoma virus. I guarantee you, everyone has Kaposi sarcoma virus. It's a herpes virus, like chickenpox. Same family, include chickenpox and the herpes viruses. You get it, you never know it. Never get sick. It has that same sort of detente with our immune system as SIV has with the monkeys. A lot of funguses, we have that. Lung funguses, we have the toxoplasma, which is maybe a little bit more to the boundary. Toxoplasma, you have AIDS. Toxoplasma starts eating your brain. If you're a pregnant woman, toxoplasma eats your brain. But if you're a healthy human being, get into a detente, and it never your immune system doesn't destroy, ravage your body, and the parasite kind of just stays. And it sort of balances out. And so this happens all the time. It's just the fact that we, in a sense, humans and AIDS have met each other too soon. And if you think about how when you have a parasite and a host meeting, there are a couple basic resolutions. You can have a fight to the death where the pathogen dies off. And that's like a lot of things that we notice when we get sick. You get a cold virus, you fight it, you eliminate it, you make it extinct in your body, and it is done, and you never have it again. Or the pathogen can win, and then you die, and then you both die. So that's a bad solution. And illnesses in the do that tend to be the most vicious because they have to rapidly jump to the next host. So like Ebola virus is an example of that. One where it's just a vicious raging infection that then spreads itself. And malaria can behave like that as well. Malaria can also behave kind of like the detente sort of way, depending if it's an area where there's sporadic burst outbreaks of malaria or if it's an area where you just get malaria as a kid and you have it for your life. And those areas, it tends to form in a detente. And then, of course, and so that the detente is the other solution where you both sort of just live with one another. And in some ways, that actually is the most beneficial state. That can go on to, like, there's bacteria that live in our skin and live in our gut. And we are just crawling with little partner organisms that probably started as sort of a detente form. We agreed not to try to kill each other. And then the bug realized that if it helped us out a little bit, everyone benefits. And so you end up with all these symbiotic relationships. And so all over our bodies, that's a key thing. So we're kind of bounced all over the place again. But colic, one of the theories about colic is the baby does not have the right friendly gut bacteria, and that's really what the baby is suffering from, is it hasn't had its partners come in yet. And that once the baby gets the proper bacteria, then everyone is happy again. And that's why. And there's actual suffering for not having your appropriate partners come with you. And so so it happens. It happens all the time, Charles. And I think HIV would, like, and then you get into, I don't know if things are like, it can go either way. And HIV actually has had a pretty good niche in humans in the sense that it's why it takes 10 years to really get to a doomed place. And that's long enough to spread, and that's long enough. And if you think about that, for most of the evolutionary existence of human beings, you know, 30 years old is an astonishingly old ancient age. We're a rare, something bizarre has happened to have humans live to nearly 80, at least in some places. It's sort of a strange idea. And so a 10 year wait is a long thing. And it's not to say we've gone to a very philosophical place. I think that it looks like, for now, I would actually say if you put me in charge, you sat me down at the Gates Foundation and gave me a gigantic pile of money and told me to end AIDS and end AIDS now, what I would say is I would do it with drugs. And the example I would say is with cholera, right? Cholera, everyone had these high ideas of how to deal with cholera, vaccines and special drugs. You know what ended up really reducing cholera deaths worldwide? Water. You know, clean drinking water and electrolyte solution. And it's the most basic recipe on earth. You have a pure water without cholera in it, 8 tablespoons of sugar and a tablespoon, or 8, sorry, you 8 teaspoons of sugar and a teaspoon of salt and a quart of water. And you drink that, as much of that as is coming out of the rest of you, and you will not die of cholera. And that's all it took. No fancy drugs, nothing more than clean water. And I think that we should at least think about just doing the over-the-top approach to AIDS, which is, you know, if you treat everyone, every single person on the planet who has HIV, it lowers, it's known, it's been shown to lower the transmission risk, it's been shown that you live a long, I mean, we're only 10 years out, but it... People live and the viral counts stay low, and we seem to be able to develop new drugs. To me, that is your solution to HIV and AIDS. You could end AIDS, certainly. You may not be able to end HIV, but you could end AIDS if you just aggressively distributed drugs. Now, that's from a scientific point of view, I recognize the political impossibility of this. That there always be a country, you know, like even a country like South Africa that seems relatively together, where there's still a lot of argument about whether or not HIV causes AIDS, which seems... it's settled. I don't think there's any legitimate scientific disagreement if HIV causes AIDS. I think it does. There are a few lucky people who are mutants who just never progress, that do have this happy median with HIV that never progresses on to AIDS. And there are even rarer people who just are naturally immune to it. But HIV causes AIDS, and it's, if you can't even agree on that, then it seems like just distributing drugs everywhere is an impossibility, even if you made them free. But I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
I think, to be honest, I think you ended at a great place. Wouldn't you say? That was really well put. Anyway, I don't know. I can't expand beyond that. Can you? No, I can't.
I don't know. Well, yeah. We solved AIDS. We solved the AIDS crisis.
You've given now. What it is that, you know, I'm always, as a person who... I'm always fascinated by rethinking problems. You know, sort of like you have this. You know, what you point out. You know, you could say water and sugar, and then you have amazingly. But you know, the way we think out problems, it seems to me that an element of just sheer intuition, just sheer imagination is involved into figuring out how do you get around this problem. I mean, often we do need to take clear steps to something, but sometimes clear steps just don't get you where you want to go. So suddenly mm-hmm. You just have to make a leap. You know what I mean? You have to put things together and make a jump in time. Mm-hmm. And you end up somewhere else, and instincts got you there. There wasn't really a logical situation. And then you sort of work yourself back, and then it makes sense to you why that might work. But right now it seems to me that kind of solution to the situation of AIDS, when the data you've sort of shared would mean that, of course, you just need – this is just needs really creative people to think about how do you deal with. I mean, right now we sort of have the army of the condoms, the army of the – you know what I mean? The barracks sort of approach to it, you know, which is – and clearly it's a biopolitical issue, meaning that there is – okay, I didn't want to get into this sort of thing. But in the 19th century, there's an approach to problems – social problems where the state became really fascinated with public health or mm-hmm. Life, the life of the population. The population became an interest of the state. People often say there was a transition from territorial concern to population concern. Like, what mm-hmm. is the population doing? What is the population made of? And then how do you manage the population? This became the essential question for the state. Not, we got to go and take over this country or that issue or so and so on. Mm-hmm. So there is this massive transition in particularly in the 19th century in sort of government concerns. And when we deal with like these issues, it seems that we use these old sort of very, very, barracks sort of factory approaches, saying that, oh, you know,
it's a product you produce and you just deal.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem to be, it lacks, the, sadly enough, the sort of flexibility that you need to make really interesting leaps into solutions.
But this gets into, I mean, this is an issue that comes up, maybe a different, what I always get worried about when trying to do this, give drugs to everyone, like a huge, and we're talking about a billion people on the planet, or two, maybe 2 billion, when you finally hear asymptote number of infected, you can do a question of autonomy. I mean, this is 19th century public health. You just that's grab right. someone off the street and stick them on Roosevelt Island,
that's
right?
Yes, that's right.
Right, and I don't know if that would fly in this era. I mean, it's somewhat of a, for the worldwide, to get that sort of agreement worldwide, to not make it a choice if you take HIV drugs, but you, if you have HIV positive, you must. I mean, that's how it would work. I mean, I don't think philosophically it would even be compatible with the way we think about ourselves anymore, where it's an individual choice. Just like people refuse to get vaccinated for mumps, you know. It seems nuts to me, but people do it.
Yes, but then here you have AIDS, and it is the disease of the global age. It's the disease that first becomes a concern, a multinational concern, in a sense that is not sort of there before, where mm-hmm. the research is all over the world and everybody's trying to figure out how to distribute drugs or how to attack the problems, but nobody seems to be working in isolation. It seems to be very much an interconnection with health services. But there's also, it seems, a lack, because there isn't a real WHO, right? There isn't really adequate way. You know, I was just thinking about this because right now you can just see how much it's lacking when you look at something like the recent crisis that they're dealing with, well, trying to prevent, which is bird flu, right? Now, the issue with bird flu is it's not so much a batter, but I mean, there isn't really an organization to address it. There isn't really a sense of there's a world that's changed a lot and movements have
interconnected
changed and all this stuff is happening. I mean, we're quick to build financial institutions to facilitate the movements of those concerns, but we have no equal kind of institution.
The World Health Organization, for a UN organization, does a very good job.
I'm not knocking there. I'm just
it's an interesting thing to say. I agree with you that it needs to grow. And this is where I think I'm very excited to be a scientist in Seattle, is that I think, you know, I always use this as a number, but, you know, the Gates Foundation building right next to the Space Needle is going to be, I think, 1 million square feet. That's a real statement in my mind of I mean, that's just the tip of a very large iceberg. And recruiting fantastic people, and I'm excited. I think Seattle has the potential to be one of the home bases of exactly that sort of organization, this sort of coming together as a worldwide community to deal with these new infectious diseases. And some old infectious diseases just now have a much greater ability to spread and to go about. And so in some ways, I feel like I'm a little bit like in 19th century New York City, which was sort of the forefront of public health in its era, or London in the 18th century, where you're at the very forefront of the ideas of how to combat illness and deal. And you know, in each of these previous two examples were just revolutionary for humanity. I mean, more. I think more than almost anything was with the public health movements and this interest. I think you very beautifully described in populations and then applying the mechanisms of science to try to deal with what comes up. And I think we've rambled far enough. I thank you again, Charles. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
And I thank you for listening.
No, thank you.